and they're not doing it. But it does do it on RR5-4, so something's wrong with their transmitter. I just wanted you to look at it and say, yeah, I, just to say that you looked at it, you know what the effect probably is.
He did look at it. I think he's confirming an EVM excessive error. Is that true, Eric?
Just let Joe answer this. So when you look on your service monitor, you see a 10 dB difference in the pilot level. Is that correct?
Affirmative.
And one last question. It's always been that different. Is that correct?
Since they moved stuff to the Trade Center, yes. Everything they moved up to the Trade Center is about almost 8 to 10 dB difference in signal level on UHF than wherever it came from before, whether it be Empire or Four Times Square.
Okay. First of all, Channel 5 and Channel 9 do not come from Four Times Square. And Channel 5 and Channel 9 do not come from World Trade Center, okay? Although there's talk now of them moving there, but that hasn't happened yet, so. What I'm getting at is that your RF conditions really haven't changed. So, it's really the EVM that's killing you. If you were able to look at what the equalizers in your receiver was doing, you'd see what I'm talking about. I can do that. I have equipment that allows me to take the stream apart, actually read the numbers of the stream, and also know what the clocks are doing and how it relates to signal strength. So, it could be one of two things. You're sitting in the null, whereas I know I am sitting in the null a little bit. The signal that I get is weaker than if I was actually going to point it directly at the antenna. But I know from experience that, you know, the RF signal strength that I'm getting now is the same as I always see it, but the EVM number is bigger than I would normally see it. So something has changed over a period of time. I don't remember when the last time I looked at it was. But it's not necessarily them, because, of course, as you get multipath, the EVM numbers go up anyway, so from the point of receiving. So, actually tomorrow, I give somebody up there a call and ask them what the transmitter's putting out. So, there you go.
I figured you probably know somebody over there. No, it's just a little annoying to try to watch a picture like that over a length of time. It's a little disturbing when you see like the thing not break up but do what it does. And I hear the crackling on me too, so I think you have a problem with the repeater here, because I think I'm hitting the main receiver most likely. I'm using the same radio as I've used all the time on the deck net. It doesn't have rattlies with it. Did you hear the static just a couple seconds ago?
I missed that. What are you saying about the repeater?
I'm listening duplex. I'm transmitting on one band, listening on another band, and I heard the crackle behind me. I've heard it a few times. You were blaming Dick on his radio. It's not his radio. My radio is doing the same thing, and it never did it before. So something else is amiss.
But when I was listening to 146.25, I heard the crackling. That's what made me say that, because I heard it coming out of the repeater, so I figured, oh, Dick has one of the strongest signals around, put it in reverse and listen to it, and there was a crackling, and when Dick hit his radio, the crackle really crackled.
Well, he might have another type of compounding problem happening with his equipment. I'm running a max track on high band, so 25 watt-er. Never had an issue with it. It's working fine. So sometimes I hear cracking in the background. I don't pay attention to it very much, and sometimes I don't.
And I'm running a Kenwood TS711A, mil spec. Believe that, I'll tell you another. If I'm trying to measure EVM, Eric, is the equipment I'm measuring that with a little bit like the measurement I use to measure a 16 QAM signal, a constellation diagram test set? Is the test a little bit like that? Because the constellation diagram test set is measuring your amplitude and phase errors of your individual dots. And that tells you the accuracy of your 16 QAM. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Good you're measuring a 16 QAM or a 32 QAM or a 64 QAM or 128 QAM or 256 QAM, there is a value called EVM. One thing that's different about APS-B as opposed to QAM is that QAM uses both I and Q, and APS-B is I only, and Q isn't used for anything.
If it's only I, then you've been talking about phase errors. So I'm a little bit confused. Go ahead.
Talking about phase errors over time, not instantaneous. If you were to look at a QAM, let's say a 16 QAM, or even a QPSK, there are four boxes that those dots are supposed to fit into, or eight boxes, or 16 boxes. And when they leave the boxes, you think of that as a phase error or some kind of nonlinear distortion. In APS-B, when you look at the constellation, not the eyes, but the constellation itself, because we use the Q to create the eyes, you're looking at eight vertical lines, and you'll see the positions of the dots consecutively over time shift to the left or shift to the right. And those are the nonlinear distortions.
So I think you're saying you've got eight vertical lines. Each vertical line has a dot that can move up and down on that vertical line. I presume that's 256 possible positions along that line, as a guess on my part. And if that vertical line shifts relative to the other vertical lines, that represents a phase error. Is that correct, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, the vertical lines actually consist of many sweeps, so to speak, and each one of those sweeps over time. If you were to take a graph and you started from the minus y-axis and you went to the plus y-axis, and you construct that line by using little dots, now you get the idea?
Yes, and I presume the amplitude of those dots represents the instantaneous pixels being transmitted. Is that true?
You gotta stop trying to think that you can correlate between pixels and RF and stuff like that. It just doesn't work that way. It's happening as you're getting a stream of numbers, and contained within those numbers is the PCR clock, is a lot of address information, there is what we call PSIP information, there's national emergency alerts information all in there. So you can't necessarily associate that with a pixel or a little blurb of sound, so to speak. You're just transmitting a digital stream. What its content is irrelevant at this point. But yeah, as you see that stuff, the line will get fatter or it'll zigzag, and those are the nonlinear distortions. The amplitude stuff is the linear distortions.
Okay, if I'm looking at a display, I see eight vertical lines. I presume the instantaneous dot on vertical line number one can be anywhere from the bottom to the top. I'm presuming the position along that line represents the amplitude of that particular dot. And so if I take the amplitude of line number one, the amplitude of line number two, and so on, that instantaneous dot pattern represents something about the digital data. I guess you could call it a frame. The frame of the digital data being transmitted at that instant. That's a bunch of guesses on my part. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
In one instant, if you were to say, the line actually is broken up into different levels. Amplitude, you are correct in terms of amplitude, where that dot is, in terms of where it is up and down, and it only moves a very slight amount. What you're looking at is the result of the IMQ minus the Q. So if it moves to the left or right outside of its boundaries, those are phase errors. If it moves up and down outside of its boundaries, it's actually eight level, let's see, it's the cellus is three, so it's actually, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Yeah, it is eight. It's eight different amplitude level within a certain portion of the line. And then they build the line over time, and that's the frame of 188 bytes worth of data. So you have eight lines across, that's eight individual VSB carriers, so to speak, or eight individual amplitude modulated positions over a single frame of time. And then you add to that line consecutively from top to bottom, I think it is. It's from top to bottom. And each one of those dots across the line represents a certain number of digits.
A dot moving along a vertical line, you said it moves slowly. I assumed it moves from frame to frame, and it's free to move, that in theory, if the two frames are sufficiently different, the dot on line number one could move from the bottom on frame number one to the top on frame number two, is my guess up till now. You said it moves slowly. Those dots do not move from frame to frame. Eric, go ahead. KQRIW.
A whole sample of dots, so to speak, as you're calling them, occurs over a 188 byte packet. I think I can pull a book out and I'll give you the exact timing. We're talking nanoseconds here. An entire frame is it's a repetitive rewrite of the screen for is it a 30th? No, it's not a 30th. It's an odd number. I have to pull the book out to give you the exact detail. But, again, you're not correlating picture information with the actual carriers and its data. The data that the eight individual sets of carriers, if you want to think of it like that, represents bits. Okay, and since the trellis uses three bits for one bit, three bits for one bit, so the relationship of, even though you have eight lines across the screen, it doesn't necessarily represent an 8-bit word. It's actually more.
Each of the eight vertical lines represents the eight subcarriers. So each of those represent a particular, in theory, exact frequency. If the lines are misplaced, does that represent an error, a frequency error of one of those subcarriers? Over to you, Eric.
Represents a phase error, because don't forget, you're building this this constellation based upon the clock that you're decoding. The noisier it is, the more the dots that are stacked one on top of each other make the line look fatter, and as you get more noise, the line gets fatter and fatter.
Okay, the placement of the eight lines represents the instantaneous phase error of each of those subcarrier frequencies. So those subcarrier frequencies have a mathematically derived phase they should be at this instant of time. Any phase error of that particular frequency component represents a horizontal displacement of one of those vertical lines. Is that roughly true?
That is correct. And the slight difference in amplitude represents a linear error.
Okay. The dot that's on, at this instant, the dot that's on line number one, where it is in vertical displacement, represents a particular amplitude. How many bits of possible amplitude are there on that particular dot on line number one? Over to you, Eric.
Now, with the trellis, you know, trellis is another piece of math, it actually can represent a total of eight levels. Because, again, we're talking amplitude modulation. Although you're saying individual carriers, they're really not individual carriers. It's just displacement in time. So, if you look at a single sweep of that signal, and you would put it through a Nyquist filter so that you can see and an inverse FFT, you can see the individual AM components of it. And you'll see that the modulation occurs in specific places across the line. And that's all associated with bit timing.
Okay, I thank you. I'm learning more. I don't have the whole picture yet. Hopefully there are a number of YouTube videos and Wikipedias that will explain 8VSB to me a little bit better. But as it presently stands, the United States is going to over-the-air broadcast, abandon 8VSB, and go over to COFDM. What's your best guess right now as to when that transition is going to take place? I think you're saying that some stations are allowed to begin transferring immediately as long as they have another frequency assignment in which they can do it. Is that roughly true, Eric? Go ahead. K2IW.
Two things. I did give you a copy of Spagnoli's book, did I not?
Yes. I got a Spagnoli book from you a couple of years ago. It's about 2 inches thick of paper, 11 by 14, and a million words, a million graphs, and I didn't understand it all. Go ahead, Eric.
Well, if you go to the section which shows off transmission, you'll see there's a diagram that actually has what looks like, you might think of it as horizontal sync pulses. There's an area at the beginning and the end, which are actually digital sync pulses, if you want to think of it that way. What it does is those things say, okay, start your decoding from this particular point. And stuffed in there is something called a PCR clock. If you look at that and read around it, he shows you how you derive from amplitude modulation, add a pseudo-random number generated to it, and then Nyquist filter it, and that's how you get the output. So if you read it again a couple more times, I think you'll really understand it. And what was the second part? Now I forgot.
When do you believe the United States is going to truly start switching over to COFDM from the 8VSB that we're now using? In other words, we're going to switch to a more European technique for over-the-air digital broadcast. Roughly when do you think that's going to take place? And I think you've told me in the past that some stations are already switching over as long as they've got another frequency assignment to do it with, as long as they keep doing 8VSB. The 8VSB is not going to truly be cut off for some time in the future, I presume. Over to you, Eric.
And at this point, there is no cutoff date for 8VSB. The thing that's being talked about is 10 years, possibly 15 years, and maybe even 20 years. The nice part about ATSC-3 or the COFDM is that it offers a lot more localization. There's feedback through the internet and a whole lot of other really good things in it. It's a software-based system that can be expanded. As of this moment, there's 11 stations around the country that are currently transmitting ATSC-3, and we're expecting that number to grow. So you can transmit ATSC-3 if you want now and join up with a sister station or another station and put your 8VSB stuff on their transmitter. So the whole concept for this is that there's channel sharing going on. Even though you might be a competing company, there's a lot of channel sharing agreements in preparation for ATSC-3. Our solution to that being PBS, we've got Channel 21, we've got Channel 13. Eventually, Channel 13 will be the ATSC-3, and Channel 21, which will be on 36 at that point, will remain 8VSB, and it will have the WLIW and WNET on it. And the way we do that is we reduce the bit rates to make it all fit.
So, as I see it, ATS-3, COFDM, cannot be simultaneously transmitted on the same carrier with 8VSB. So therefore, you're choosing another RF carrier to do the ATS-3 transmissions on. And quite often that's being done by sharing somebody else's, another dash number, another squeeze in all those other dash numbers, the actual bit rate may have to go down. And that sounds like there's going to be less and less 4K over the air broadcast. Over to you, Eric, K2LIW.
Well, let me tell you that that's an incorrect assumption. First of all, AVSV cannot transmit 4K. Yes, they can, but you won't be able to receive it anywhere. Simply because your TV sets that receive 8VSV, the standard for the video compression is MPEG-2. And the standard for video compression in 4K, or even 8K, is something called HEVC, which is high-efficiency video coding. In order to make a really good 4K picture, you need a bit more bandwidth, but you could do it on 8VSV, but that's not the way it's going to happen.
I just read, I think last week, that the Samsung and LG, which are already producing ATS-63 for Korea, are now going to start delivering them to the United States. So I figure by the end of the year you can go to your local store and buy a receiver that receives analog, it receives 8VSV, it receives QAM, like if you plug it straight into your cable, and it will receive COFDM, which would be ATSC3. K2RWK2J.
There's 13 stations around the United States that are already transmitting ATS-3. They have local communities that are sufficiently affluent that they're buying equipment and able to receive those signals. I presume these stations are not just transmitting it into the into the black world where nobody's receiving it. So I presume these are in the major metro areas where there's a very progressive clientele. Is that roughly true, Eric? Go ahead.
The stations that are currently transmitting all have test receivers at various different locations, and, you know, like Sinclair has got a bunch of them that they're currently working on a distributed or a single frequency network. There's a station in Oregon that is doing experiments. There's a station in Ohio. There's a station in Washington, two stations in Washington, D.C., and a couple more. Some of them are working together and doing channel sharing so that the individual home receiver in those areas, they don't see any difference. They may have actually moved transmitters and they might have had to rescan their receiver. But as far as the home viewer is concerned, you know, 3-1 or 4-1 or whatever it is in their particular coverage area, it all shows up in the same place on the TV set, and it just, it's coming from a different transmitter, which might be right next to the one that's doing ATSC3. It's different arrangements with different people, but at this point, it's still kind of experimental, and what they're doing is they're proving out. And, by the way, I'm going to drop again. There are experiments where they're actually doing an interleaved 8VSV plus COFDM out of the same transmitter by doing notching and timing. And it seems to work, but that's not going to happen.
Wow. Interstitial diffusion. In other words, a little bit like... I can't even think of the letters for it now. DRFM, where you can have multiple people talking over the same carrier, time domain or duplexing. Wow. So the majority of these 13 stations are running experiments. They've got the experimental receivers looking at the quality it's received under various conditions. So in other words, these transmitters are not doing it necessarily for the clientele. They're doing it for the test operation. Is that the major reason for what's going on right now? And are they finding less vulnerability of ATS-3 compared to 8VSV? Over to you, Eric, K2LIW.
No, what the Sinclair group has done, and they were the big purveyors of doing COFDM in the first place, as opposed to they were against 8VSV. The systems that they set up are going to be permanently in place, although... The experimental ones that are happening now are not running what would be the full power at the end. They're running a reduced power.
but still making, you know, the grade A coverage, or what it is, the way the FCC calls it, they're operating at a nominal level before maximization. And maximization can be tens of kilowatts more than what they're doing now, especially on UHF.
So now, did I hear you correctly that the ATS-3 transmissions can give you the same quality at the same range with a smaller amount of RF power compared to 8 VSB? Did I almost hear you say those words, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, the whole concept behind 8 VSB is that it fits in the same space as your analog channel. The reason why they chose the 8 VSB is because you get better coverage. You need less power for the same coverage area than you would with CLFDM.
Would you and I and other people in a fringe area, like, say, Southampton, be equally happy with 8 VSB if 8 VSB had been set up to use the exact same amount of average transmitting power compared to the old analog station that they used to watch with their over-the-air antenna on a tower in Southampton? Over to you, Eric, KQRIW.
Well, the concept of 8 VSB is that your analog transmitter that might have been 60 kilowatts peak power at sync, you could run 4 kilowatts and get the same coverage of 8 VSB.
So did you say 8 kilowatts of peak power becomes 4 kilowatts of 8 VSB? Is those the numbers you just gave me? Go ahead.
Well, I said 60 kilowatts of analog peak power at sync. The equivalent coverage area in 8 VSB is around 4 kilowatts. Of course, it depends on frequency and so on and so forth, and the numbers get closer together when you go down to VHF.
Okay, the 60 kilowatts analog versus 4 kilowatts 8 VSB is somebody's very nice, optimistic calculation on paper. On channel, on lower VHF channels, I am guessing that has not been confirmed in the field. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
If you're going to make a statement like that, you're going to have to say, okay, the reference that we're going to use in analog is a ghost-free, noise-free picture with an SNR at burst of being, say, 35 to 45 dB. And if we're going to use that as the standard, because once you get past a certain distance, you start to get noise, you start to get other things, and of course both things will get ghosts from reflections and multicap. But when you put it on an equal footing, where, you know, what is an acceptable picture, they match up with each other.
I think I've heard that numbers like 40 dB of carrier-to-noise ratio with analog is required to be essentially snow-free. I've heard numbers as high as 47 dB of carrier-to-noise ratio requirement. Whereas with 8 VSB, I guess you can have what looks like a noise-free picture at numbers like, 18 dB of carrier-to-noise ratio. Eric, go ahead.
Oh, that's correct. That's kind of pushing it, but yeah. You can get, when you get a digital picture, it's noise-free. There's no noise involved. Either you get it, or you get blocked, or you get nothing.
And so most of the time, I would be getting my blocks without the dropouts at 18 or maybe 20 dB of carrier-to-noise ratio with 8 VSB. If I don't have co-channel interference and a moderate amount of multipath. If my multipath signal, with the worst possible delay of the multipath, if that multipath signal is not 18 dB weaker, I'm probably in trouble. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, it is. There's a minimum number that you can't go below because it's a cliff effect. And the same thing with, say, DMR. DMR is TDMA, which is a little bit different. Actually, when you transmit on your HT, you don't realize it, but you're transmitting on and off. You're transmitting 20 milliseconds, and it goes off for 5 milliseconds and transmit again for 20 milliseconds. That's why people who hook up a bird to the DMR, they see the meter wiggling up and down, and that's the reason for it. But APSB is a continuous stream that's not being broken. It's not it's not TDMA. And let me let it drop again. CLFDM has an advantage in that you're transmitting, I think, at 1024 actual individual carriers, and when you get multipath and it cancels some of it out, you're still getting pictures. You've got to think of CLFDM more like a hologram where you can cut part of it away and you still got the whole thing.
Does that say that COFDM has many of the desirable characteristics of MIMO, multiple input, multiple output? Go ahead.
Now, if you're thinking in terms of, like, what the cell phones do, because they MIMO a lot of stuff, kind of, sort of, but not really, because when you lose part of it from multipath and stuff like that, the bit rate of what you recover actually slows down a little bit, but there's enough information there with the error correction to reconstruct a full picture. It might not update as fast. There are other little artifacts that come into play, but it's kind of like if you were sitting watching a noisy, snowy, ghosty picture, you would still see in the analog world, you would still see a solid picture on COFDM, but you might not have the same high frequency information that gives you sharp edges around the characters or graphics or things like that. The artifacts come in different forms, and it's kind of, in this country, we're still learning about it, whereas in Europe, they know all about it.
Sounds like a very adaptive system. In the case of DMR, where I'm transmitting for 20 milliseconds on and some number of milliseconds off. I've heard various numbers on that. Does that allow two separate people talk at the input of a single repeater simultaneously, holding two separate repeated conversations? Does DMR give you that capability, Eric? Go ahead.
It does. Let me simply explain how that's possible. When you first key up your transmitter, it sends out a little burst. Little burst talks to the repeater and says, "Hey, I'm here. Send me a sync pulse." The repeater sends back a pulse and says, "Okay, your timing starts now." So what happens is this directed sync pulse that goes back to your receiver says, your transceiver says, "Okay, I got it. I'm going to transmit now. I transmit for 20 milliseconds, I stop transmitting, and I listen to the repeater to acknowledge that it got that packet information. And then it says, okay, hang on now for another 20 milliseconds while the other slot, as they call it, has its opportunity." So it is a directed system where the repeater is the master, and it tells the transceivers when to talk and when to listen.
So therefore, Dick with his DMR radio transmitting signal number one, and Eric with his DMR radio transmitting signal number two, and we're both going through a repeater in, say, Mineola, and I'm talking to my favorite guy, and you're talking to your favorite guy, and all of that is kept separate if the timing is done just right, and we're both transmitting 20 milliseconds on and maybe 20 milliseconds off bursts of packets. Is that roughly true, Eric, of digitized audio, K2RIW?
Well, if you ever listen to DMR, and, well, first of all, if you had two radios, you had two scopes, and you could see, or two idiot lights that says which one is actually putting out RF, you'll see it actually switch back and forth between the two radios. The concept of audio, what we've done is we've now taken a bunch of audio, you say blah, 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 that gets digitized, it gets put into storage, and then it's broken up into packets of a specific length. I can't remember exactly how many bits it is, but it's X number of bits wide, and then it waits until it's told it can transmit again, and then it'll transmit that same number of packets with the next segment of audio. And then at the receiver, the audio or the data is put into storage, and it hangs out there until the next one comes along, and that delay, that propagation delay that you hear when you actually talk into one, you hear the delay come out of the other. That's because your packets are being reconstructed into a continuous stream of audio.
In the case of DMR, what's the least, what's the most amount of latency that you've heard? If you're listening to what's coming back out on radio number two, and you're transmitting on radio number one, is there roughly a half second delay like you've got on some cell phone systems? Eric, go ahead.
There's actually a specific number. I think it's something like 750 milliseconds.
7/10 of a second of delay. And so if you wanted to run full duplex and you listen to your own voice coming back 0.7 seconds later, I can tell you without a lot of training, it's very hard to keep talking when you hear your own voice come back with that delay. Over to you, Eric. Have you ever tried that experiment?
I do it in the car all the time. I can't, you know, it's like when we're going through the internet, you don't want to listen to 375, same sort of deal. But it's not as bad as the delays in the internet. So, you know, it's livable. Actually, a lot of your talent on air, you know, when you're looking at a news show and they're talking to London, they're kind of used to that. And what they do is they use something called an interrupt. It's phoned back, so that way they don't hear themselves with the delay because it'll just make them flip up. And every now and then you'll see they forget to either set up the IFB or they don't insert the delay so that things match up. You'll see them get a little befuddled on air.
Yeah, we've often heard about a personality on camera using IFB, interrupted fallback or interrupted feedback. So in other words, his own voice does not come back into his ear with that delay, which will be, of course, be confusing. Okay, I'm going to give you guys a little bit of the information on what I mentioned earlier. If I take a full-size antenna on 80 meters, for instance, 80-meter dipole would be 132 feet long, and then I decide I'm going to make a compact version of it, and I make a dipole on 80 meters, 32 feet long instead of 132, by way of the Brown and Woodward curves, and you know where they're located, I can find out what the exact impedance of that antenna is going to be. I don't know the exact numbers, but I'm going to make some guesses. The reactive component is probably going to be 4,000 ohms, and the resistive component is probably going to be 10 ohms. So the standing wave ratio is going to be some huge number, like 50 to 1. And as such, if you transmitted that antenna directly, the transmitter would give you a very poor performance. If you had, let me drop. If you had an extremely broadband antenna tuner that could tolerate a 50 to 1 standing wave ratio, and your antenna tuner is lossless, it's a real good one, and it's mounted right at the antenna, that antenna will give you the exact same performance as that full-size dipole within 4/10 of a dB. When you shrink a dipole to an infinitesimal size, because of change in the antenna pattern getting a little bit fatter, you never lose as much as 4/10 of a dB. It's 0.39 dB. You can check on this by going to search the word dipole, D-I-P-O-L-E, plus Wikipedia. And you look at the Wikipedia beautiful article on dipoles, and there's a section way down on that page that will show you what happens to the gain of an antenna as you shrink its size, a dipole antenna. And the pattern becomes a little bit fatter, and you lose 4/10 of a dB of forward gain, but you gain it in other areas. It's still running at 100% efficiency. Let me drop. So various people have very truthfully told us that when they use a compact antenna, they see something like 1 S-unit or so of decreased performance. And if the theory tells you that the antenna itself can't lose more than 4/10 of a dB, that's a very big difference from 1 S-unit, which is 6 dB. So is it the antenna that's doing it? No. Let me drop. when you put the antenna tuner in the shack on the other end of that good piece of transmission line, it could be a piece of RG8 being used at 80 meters, where the insertion loss is probably something like a 4/10 of a dB per 100 feet or some number like that. However, when that antenna is running at an extremely high, when the transmission line is running at an extremely high VSWR, what the antenna tuner is doing is taking all of that reflected power, and maybe 95% of the power is being reflected. It takes all that reflected power that hits the output end of the antenna tuner and re-reflects it forward, where it goes back to the antenna and another 5% gets radiated, another 95% gets reflected back. So the signal is bouncing back and forth on the transmission line a very large number of times. Therefore, the 4/10 of a dB of insertion loss one way of the transmission line gets multiplied by some great big number. That big number could be 6 or 10 dB of total loss. There is a formula. Let me drop. There is a much more complicated formula that you can use for measuring in-service transmission line true insertion loss when being used in a high VSWR environment with an ideal antenna tuner at the bottom end of the transmission line. There is a formula that gives that to you. It's got a whole lot of extra terms. It's doing this infinite series calculation for you as to what the total loss is. So, the people who have complained that the compact antennas give them less performance, they thought it was the antenna itself being physically small, having a smaller effective capture area. Good common sense. Not true. The antenna system, the transmission line, antenna tuner plus antenna, is giving you decreased performance because of the excess loss of the transmission line. Let me drop. So when various people like George truthfully was telling us, KD2 FIU, that his compact antennas gave him decreased performance of like an S unit or so, he was telling the truth. He was using good common sense and believed it was the antenna itself. I'm reasonably sure it was the transmission line. So it exists. So it's not the antenna unless, and only if you're willing to do the antenna tuning right at the antenna would that go away. And if there's only one particular favorite frequency you got, you can build a simple LC network, one inductor, one capacitor, an L network, with just the right value capacitor and just the right value inductor mounted at the antenna to correct that crazy impedance for you, and then the transmission line will see a one-to-one. That's the good news. You could do that. Let me drop. Because a compact antenna is so extremely high in Q, so extremely narrow band, you'd have to readjust that inductor and capacitor every time you QSY more than, let me pick a number, 20 or 50 KC. So unless you've got only one favorite frequency, that's not a practical approach. And for most of us, to buy a high-quality, very broad-range antenna tuner that is remotely operatable and putting the antenna tuner right at the antenna, dollar-wise and cost-wise and physical-wise, that's not very practical for an awful lot of us. So that, yes, you do suffer the overall system performance decrease with an antenna tuner, with a compact antenna. But it's not the antenna that's doing it. The infinitesimal dipole, properly impedance matched, gives you never more than 4/10 of a dB of loss compared to a full-size antenna. That, of course, is crazy. Let me drop.
AC2GS?
Go right ahead, Roy. K2RIW.
Hey, I hope no one minds that I'm going to quote from Wikipedia, but you brought Wikipedia up, and I think we have to keep in mind radiation resistance, but this is the quote. Dipoles that are much smaller than the wavelength of the signal are called short dipoles. These have a very low radiation resistance and high capacitive reactance, making them inefficient antennas. More of a transmitter is dissipated as heat due to the infinite due to the finite resistance of the conductors, which is greater than the radiation resistance. However, they can nevertheless be practical receiving antennas for longer wavelengths. So what I get out of this is the insertion losses become much, much more important as you shorten the antenna and decrease its radiation resistance.
I'm glad you brought that up, Roy. There's a yes and a no to that. Without a doubt, when you say the radiation resistant, that's a fancy way of saying the resistive component of the impedance. Many people call that the radiation resistance. Yes, the radiation resistance might go down to 1 ohm at a very short antenna. The resistive component goes down to 1 ohm. If you've constructed the antenna out of very low loss materials, if I built that 80-meter dipole out of 4-gauge copper wire that's silver-plated, I would get no heating of that dipole, even though its radiation resistance would be 1 ohm. Its real I-squared-R ohmic resistance might be a few milliohms, even including the skin resistance, if you know what I mean. So if I use the right materials, the antenna does not have to become inefficient. If I still made it out of 16-gauge wire, yes, I'm in trouble. I'd have to use fatter wire. But if I'm smart enough with the right materials, the appropriate chapter of Krauss's book, Antennas, talks about the infinitesimal dipole having no real extra radiation insertion loss once you resonate it. And so there's a mixture of terms going on with that particular Wikipedia article. Over to you, Roy, AC2GS, K2RIW.
The problem, as I kind of see it, is that you really have to take it as the entire antenna system. So not only do you have to build your antenna like a brick whatever, you also have to impedance match it with the same either superconducting material or copper that's plated in the finest silver without any kind of imperfections and such, because it's not as much that there are insertion losses inherent in the shortened antenna, but any insertion loss in the entire antenna system become profoundly more important because of the lower radiation resistance that you're dealing with in the circuit. That's at least what I got out of that.
I agree with you, Eric. You have to use much more heroic approaches. The antenna itself may have an inherent Q of, let me pick a number, 300, as opposed to 10. A good dipole has a Q of 10. An extremely short dipole might have a Q of 300. Therefore, you need very high Q components of your antenna tuner and of the antenna construction itself in order to get all of the benefit and to not get all of these losses. Now, when it comes to building circuits that can maintain a Q of 300 with low insertion loss, we amateurs do it every single day per se. That's what your duplexing filter is doing on a repeater. The filter on a repeater that allows you to transmit and receive simultaneously with the same antenna, those cavities in that filter probably have a Q of 5,000. They're operating as if the antenna had a Q of 300, so to speak. You're trying to maintain very high isolation between transmit signal and receiver signal. Yes, it's a heroic piece of hardware. Let me drop this. It's very volumetric, but if you want that efficiency, it is achievable. If you're willing to use components that are one quarter the size, so to speak, of a duplexing filter as your antenna tuner and mount that at the antenna, you could get 95% efficiency with an infinitesimal dipole and make it all work over a very narrow frequency. You'd have to retune it every time the QSY. We're not likely to go there. However, the laws of physics will allow you to do it quite easily at one particular frequency if that was your major goal. So up till now, we've thought that a small antenna has a small capture area. Absolutely not. The capture area stays within a few percent the exact same. How can an antenna with less physical area have the same capture area? That's the effect of the extremely high Q. Let me drop. The extremely high Q of the antenna is generating a huge magnetic field around the antenna is one way of looking at it. It is making up that area that you lost when you shrunk down the dipole. I didn't say this is an easy concept to absorb, but let me throw that out for this week. We've had enough of that one for now. We're way beyond the point we should be going over to the science talk. And Roy, go right ahead, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW, and the Tech Dad.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. This is AC2GS, and just to remind everyone that if you have any questions or topics that you want to address or comments to make or opinions about what you like or what you don't like, email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Also, everything that I'm going to talk about pretty much is going to have a link to my website, roy.ac2gs.com. You just type that into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com, and it will give you links to every topic that I cover tonight. Also, if anyone's interested in the chat room, you can either find the address of the chat room in the front page of Limark, or I made it easier for people. All you have to do on your browser is type chat.ac2gs.com. Let me drop. Now, as I recall, Steve KD2HUC had a question. He actually gave me the question in the chat room, but let's pause for a second and see if he's able to get into the repeater.
Yeah, Roy, I'm here. KD2HUC.
Okay, Steve, do you want to repeat your question for the audience?
Sure. This week I reviewed a study from a consultant, and the nature was a bunch of things, but one of the things that stuck out was they were looking at the number of suicides around train stations, people deciding to end it and jump in front of trains, and which of course creates all kinds of havoc for the train systems. So a report I was reading this past week indicated that in both Japan and the UK, they tried lighting up all of the stations with a specific wavelength of blue LED light. Supposedly, this curtailed a great number of these occurrences. And they gave a bunch of reasons why they thought... very simplistic, saying, well, blue reminds people of police and they feel like they're going to get into trouble and a whole bunch of other stuff. But one of the more scientific reasons they gave was saying that when you expose people, the human eye, to a specific wavelength of blue light, it can actually alter their mental state. And, I mean, as me and Roy, conversed in the chat room, you know, somebody who's really emotionally disturbed enough that's, you know, considering suicide, is it possible that simple exposure to blue light could change their line of thinking? And I'm somewhat skeptical, but the results that they're getting abroad are rather remarkable. So I asked the question to Roy, what does he think? Can blue light really change somebody's emotional state? KD2HUC, back to net.
Okay, thank you very much, Steve. And I actually linked an article on this subject on my page. It'll be available in about an hour or so. And indeed, the Japanese apparently have had a great deal of problems with people committing suicide in general. They're one of the highest per capita suicide rate countries out there, unfortunately. And they reported as much as one suicide attempt per day on the train tracks in Japan, which is horrendous. So they've been trying all kinds of things. They tried barriers, which they found to be very expensive, so they couldn't deploy them to every station. And it had the effect of decreasing the suicide rate in the areas that had the barriers, but then it kind of went over to the stations that didn't have the barriers. Depressed, suicidal people would simply go to another station to kill themselves. Let me drop. So what they came up with is blue lighting in each station. And the callback to that is something called seasonal affective disorder, which I'm sure everyone's heard. There's usually an article or two every winter time. When it comes winter and the total amount of illumination decreases, people tend to get a little depressed, a little sadder than usual. And a lot of people think that it's due to the decrease in light as opposed to other things like holidays and such going on. And they found that blue light can be effective in seasonal affective disorder and generally in kind of raising people's attitudes a little bit. Now, how much of this is psychosomatic? How much is this real? I'm not quite sure. Let me drop. In addition, people who have Apple products, and I'm sure Android has the same thing available, has timers that will actually decrease the blue tint in your screen as night comes on, because there's some belief that intense blue light late at night will disrupt your sleeping cycle and make it difficult for you to sleep. So it'll actually block the blue light at night, a lot of these products will. The Japanese seem to have been very successful. They had a 10-year study and found an 84% decline in suicide attempts using just these blue displays. They oftentimes didn't even explain to the people there what the blue displays were about. So it seems to have worked for them. Again, I don't know. You know, the Japanese are a very homogeneous, very, very atypical society, so I don't know if you can do that across the board. I know that in the UK they're trying it, although I haven't seen any particular numbers. So it's possible. They sell blue lights. Every winter I see ads all over the place for these blue lights for rooms and kitchens and bedrooms to make people happier. Again, I'm not quite sure how much of this is real and how much of this is imagined, but I will link to the page where it discusses that and many other ways that railroad stations are trying to manipulate their customers to lessen the harm that goes on there. Let me drop for any comments or questions.
US2N?
Yes, Paul.
On board the International Space Station, they used to have regular bulbs, and now they've switched over to LEDs. But the ones that tend to illuminate blue, you know, a bluish hue to it, actually decreases the amount of natural sleep and also the amount of melatonin. So they actually did not only studies, but you know, they actually have this on the International Space Station. So in the morning they'll have the blue light, which will it tends to make them feel better, and then they change that at nighttime. So they kind of get away from the blue light at night. So I don't know if that means anything. Back to you.
Thank you, Paul. Yeah, it's the same thing with my iPad. I have it set up to around 9 o'clock at night. It starts to go a little on the yellow because a bright blue light is people's understanding this week that disrupts your sleep pattern. And also, you know, nothing is 100% good. And blue light has problems as well. There's some concern that a lot of bright blue light will accelerate macular degeneration. It has a greater effect on the back of the retina and such. So the universe gives you stuff with one hand and takes it back with the other. But it's an interesting study. I'd be very interested to find out how things went in England when they tried it, and I would love a breakdown in the seasonal aspects. If it's more successful during the winter months than the summer months, or it's 84% decline over the entire year. Some of that information I couldn't find from these articles.
Well, Paul just talked about the nighttime and the daytime in the International Space Station. Because it takes 90 minutes to make a trip around the Earth, they see 16 sunrises and 16 sunsets per 24-hour period. So what I'm pretty sure you're referring to, Paul, is that each of these guys have something like a 24-hour schedule where a certain number of those hours are dedicated towards sleeping, waking up, and doing work, and so on. So they declare a virtual day and night for the staff but that's not what they see out the window. Every hour and a half, there's another sunrise and another sunset. WS2N for any comment, and then pass it back to Roy. KQRW, you got a poll.
Yeah, the space station's a big place. The sleep area, which is, in that case, Unity for the American side. And picture one cylinder, and that's Unity, you know, one module. And then put a person, you know, on one side, another person on top, another person on bottom. So, you know, you have four sleeping areas. That's the area that they're fooling with the lights. You know, the sleep area. So the rest of it, you know, could be all lit up. You know, things, you know.